loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by John Kiriakou. First, we go over this week's biggest news. It was a busy week with Donald Trump withdrawing from the planned summit with North Korea and the FBI admitting that it had an informant or a spy or a rat inside the Trump campaign. Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill are predictably taking sides, and the country is more polarized on the issues as ever. And then the country is inching closer to midterm elections in November, and more states held primary elections this week. We'll take a look at those races and more political news.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, former movie mogul Harvey Weinstein turned himself into New York police this morning to face felony rape charges. Weinstein also has been accused of sexually harassing, abusing, and assaulting dozens of women over the years. Meanwhile, at least eight women have come forward to accuse film star Morgan Freeman of making unwanted sexual advances to them. Freeman released a statement saying, quote, "I apologize to anyone who felt uncomfortable or disrespected. That was never my intent," unquote. Next, Julian Assange's nearly six-year refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London is in jeopardy, multiple sources are telling CNN. If the Ecuadorians expel him, he will likely be arrested by British authorities and extradited to the United States. Then, Australia and the Netherlands say they are holding Russia responsible for the downing of a Malaysia Airlines passenger jet that killed 298 people in 2014. Dutch investigators on Thursday concluded that the missile that brought the jet down over rebel-held territory in Ukraine belonged to a Russian brigade. Is this a sure thing, or is this the fog of war? And then Colombia will hold national elections on Sunday, and it appears likely that left-wing candidate Gustavo Petro and far-right contender Iván Duque will advance to the second round. The election is the first since an historic peace deal ended a 50-year-long war between the government and the FARC insurgent group and could decide its fate. And finally, we take a look at the worst and most misleading headlines of the week. And in other headlines, after a press conference, an official letter signed by President Trump canceling the U.S.-North Korea summit, Trump said to reporters this morning, quote, "We'll see what happens. It could even be the 12th. We're going to talk to them now. That's very much what they want to do. We'd like to do it. We're going to see what happens," unquote. An Amazon Alexa device belonging to a woman in Portland, Oregon, recorded a personal conversation between she and her husband and sent it to someone in her contacts list. Though the Amazon help desk told the woman to immediately turn off the device because the error was due to hacking, the company has now confirmed that the device actually made a series of errors itself and that there was no hacking involved. The new mandate of Lebanese Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri has begun following a vote by the country's newly elected parliament. Under the current Lebanese political system, which is based on complex sectarian quotas, the prime minister is selected from among the Sunni Muslim politicians, and Hariri received an overwhelming majority of votes. Last year, Hariri was held in Saudi Arabia by the country's monarchy in what is widely considered to have been a kidnapping, and he was forced to resign before then rescinding his resignation after being released. Ireland is holding a historic and hotly contested referendum on abortion today. Voters are choosing whether or not to revoke Article 8 of the Irish Constitution, the main roadblock to legal abortion. Article 8 was implemented in 1983 as part of a conservative backlash against the legalization of contraception in 1974. Those are today's headlines. Next up, we'll review the week's biggest news.
Loud and clear.
But first, we turn to Donald Trump withdrawing from the planned summit with North Korea and the FBI admitting that it had an informant, or a spy, or a rat inside the Trump campaign. Democrats and Republicans on Capitol Hill are predictably taking sides, and the country is more polarized on these issues than ever. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. And we're joined from Norfolk, Connecticut by Patrick Lawrence. He's the author of Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century. And he's a columnist at The Nation. You can support his work at www.patreon.com/theflautist. Gentlemen, welcome back.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much, John. Good to be here.
Thank you. I want to start with the North Korea thing. You know, Donald Trump has proven to be so incredibly unpredictable. You really don't know where he's going to be from one minute to the next. And this is a prime example. Now, he just gave a press conference this morning. And this is what he said at the press conference. He said, and this is specifically about the summit with North Korea. He said, quote, "We'll see what happens. It could even be the 12th. We're talking to them now. They very much want to do it. We'd like to do it. We're going to just see what happens," unquote. So what was the point of canceling this thing in the first place? Jim, let's start with you. I want to ask you, do you think this message that we heard a couple of days ago from Vice President Pence was a coordinated message meant to torpedo these talks, or was Pence out on his own on this?
I suspect that he's been talking to Bolton. And
right.
I think, you know, my prediction when this happened in March, when Trump first announced this, I wrote a thing saying there's only a 50-50 chance at best that this is going to happen. The people in the quote-unquote deep state are going to work very hard to either to undermine this one way or another, either beforehand or by presenting demands on the scene that will be ridiculous and impossible. So the whole thing is, you know, and as you say, Trump is so impulsive that he doesn't really think before he speaks. And when he made this commitment or, you know, in March, it had not been prepared. This is something, you know, when you do things like this, when Kissinger went to China, you know, this is prepared in advance. This was just something he said off the top of his head. And the deep state was going to turn around right away and try and work against it in some way or another. Now, he has a personal, and he's writing something, hey, this could be a big thing for me personally. I make peace with Korea. He doesn't, I don't even think he understands what all is involved in that. But, you know, on the one hand, he wants to be Mr. Tough Guy. On the other hand, he wants this big feather in his cap. So you're going to see this. Wait a minute if you want to know what's going to happen in Korea. Because you're going to see it. Bolton and these people who are serious deep state apparatus people are going to be working against this, whether it's to cancel the summit or whether it's to make sure that whatever's presented at this summit is going to be absolutely unacceptable to Korea, to North Korea.
Patrick, when you watch CNN or MSNBC, anchors there, reporters there mock the term deep state. I happen to believe there is a deep state. You don't have to call it that. You can call it the federal bureaucracy, or you can call it the state or the government or whatever. But there really is an enormous group of people who are unelected and who generally don't answer to anybody, not really anyway. And they can wait out presidents. They're there forever, 20, 30, 35 years in government. And they're actually running things. I can't help but to place John Bolton in that category. He's unelected. He really is running the show. And his interests may not be what this president's interests are, or his interests may not be what the Secretary of Defense's interests or Secretary of State's interests are. So are we seeing an internal battle playing out, or is this really just Donald Trump being his normal, unpredictable self?
No, excellent question. Just where I was going to head, no matter what you ask me, frankly. I proposed to Jim to remove the quotation marks. You don't need them around deep state. The term offends people, but unless one is willing to offend people, you're not going to really make any progress in life, right? I think the distinguishing mark of Donald Trump, the man, is that he's not part of the deep state. I'm with what Jim said, but we really do need to be extremely careful here. Read Trump's letter yesterday. Listen to his presser this morning, such as you quoted. Trump wants this. He's right, right? I see a very profound fissure in here, in the administration, between the deep state apparatus and the president. He's a captive, this man. What he says, you need to pick apart very finely. What is it in here that Trump means, and what is it in here that Trump is obliged to say? Right. In this case, I think he means it. He's fighting the fight for this, in my surmise. Of course, it's very opaque, but he's not surrendering. I tip my cap to him at this on this point. Right. It's Bolton. Nikki Haley, Pompeo is kind of good cop in the good cop, bad cop scene here, right? And Mattis, let's think about Mattis a moment. He's cast by the liberals as the reasonable voice in the administration. Nonsense. He's part of the whole game. In my analysis of late, Mattis's function is very plain. Keep us stable internationally while we undermine a president and enact a bloodless coup. Mattis is the man who sort of keep the ship upright. We're going to have a domestic mess, right? That's he's part of the game, Mattis. I don't enter into this this liberal tendency to Mattis and McMaster, right? They're two vigorous warmongers, right? Mattis
right.
prefers wars. Mattis prefers wars he can win, and there aren't that many of those around right now. Otherwise, he would be fighting them.
It is really remarkable that Mattis is considered to be a moderate. I mean, this is a guy who lost his coveted position in the military under the Obama administration because he was basically opposed to the policy of signing the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. He wanted, you know, effectively, eventually down the road, a war, I think. Jim, just on Korea, one last thing that I wanted to make a point of is that, you know, Trump's narrative is that, well, through the maximum pressure campaign, by putting these horribly restrictive sanctions on North Korea, we forced them to the table. But I kind of view it to be the other way around. You know, the DPRK in North Korea, they developed a nuclear arsenal. They developed their missile technology to the point that, you know, they're able to, you know, perhaps put the mainland United States within range. And so the balance of forces shifted, you know, rather than the United States being the nuclear power as well as the, you know, overwhelming military hegemon, the balance of forces shifted a bit or, you know, quite substantially. And so there was really no options other than, you know, initiating a war against North Korea. Short of that, really, the United States had no choice but to enter into negotiations. What do you think about that?
I think that's absolutely right. I think there was an article by Trudeau Parsi today or yesterday in the Nation about that regarding Iran, the same thing. The claim is because of the sanctions, we put so much pressure, they came to the table. Actually, North Korea, as you say, developed atomic weapons and a real arsenal. Iran tripled its nuclear enrichment capacity. And it got to the point where, in the case of Iran, the Americans had to allow the Iranians to keep their enrichment capacity for peaceful purposes, which they wanted to stop them from doing. And in the case of Korea now, they're coming to the table. And a few days ago, Donald Trump was saying, oh, maybe we can't get them to completely denuclearize right away. So, yes, as you're saying, what they've done is they've created a situation that the choice now is even more stark. The only way they can get what they demand, what they purport to demand, which is complete denuclearization or for Iran or Korea, is war. And I don't think that's a mistake either. I think there are people who really want that war. But that's the situation that's happened. And the sanctions didn't weaken these other powers in the way that they wanted them to.
No, they never do.
They had real serious economic effects, but it didn't stop them from moving forward on the military and nuclear issues.
Go ahead, Patrick.
May I put in here? Yeah. The sanctions have quite seriously diminished the Iranian economy. There's no question this is causing all kinds of political problems, too, as well as economic, right? In my read, this is not often said. It's not. It won't be in any way popular. But I think the Iranians gave way too much away to get that accord. They were very needful of it, right? One could step back and say the accord was indeed a mistake. It singles out the Iranians and casts them as a problem in the region. That's wrong. The Iranians have advocated for a long time a regional security mechanism whereby all such conflicts as we now see can be resolved. That would be, and nobody is singled out for nuclear disarmament or anything else, right? In that respect, you actually could argue against the pact. I don't like it because the Iranians gave too much away, but still, it was their choice. They needed it, right? If I may make another point, the Iranians are not trafficking in deterrence. I think we need to be clear on that. The North Koreans are, right? The deterrence is key in North Korea. It doesn't have that much to do with the Iranian circumstance, right? My position is I am opposed to any situation that requires deterrence. Any situation that does require deterrence, I'm absolutely for it. Deterrence, North Korea's possession of a nuclear deterrent, we should all be very pleased that North Korea has a nuclear deterrent. It's kind of a weird thought. But think about it. There's no arguing against it. I'm rather pleased Kim Jong-un has achieved a deterrent. It changed the entire game.
Yeah. Gentlemen, let's switch to another issue here. And this is the issue of these allegations that the FBI was spying on the Trump campaign. There's a terrific piece in today's Washington Post saying that it was Trump himself who insisted that this be branded spying, that the person involved, Stephen Halper, was not an informant. He was not a CI. He was a spy. On a personal note, I've been on a lot of news shows this week, and people are asking me exactly this question. I've come to the personal conclusion that he's a spy for a couple of reasons. Number one, Halper first came to the attention of the FBI when John Brennan, who was CIA director in the summer of 2016, called a meeting with representatives from the FBI and from the National Security Council, saying that the CIA had received a tip from the Estonian intelligence service that the Russians were trying to infiltrate the Trump campaign. Like a lot of tips in the intelligence world, it turned out to be false. But it was that tip that sort of opened the door for the FBI to place Stephen Halper in the Trump campaign or in the vicinity of the Trump campaign. Even after the Estonian information was proven to be false, the FBI elected to keep him in the campaign and he was reporting back. That's one thing. The second thing is, if he's a CI, if he's a snitch, he's not going to get paid. He's doing it because he's a patriotic American. Stephen Halper is getting paid by the FBI. That's number two. Number three, and to me, this is the most important thing. If the FBI believed that there was a hostile attempt, possibly a Russian attempt, to infiltrate the campaign, what they would have done in a normal situation is to go to the candidate or to go to the campaign chairman and say, you have a counterintelligence problem in your campaign. We want to work with you to root it out. That's what they would normally do. They didn't do that in this case. What they did is they just kept spying. And even after they didn't find any evidence through Carter Page and through George Papadopoulos that there was such Russian interference, they kept Stephen Halper in the campaign to report back to them. To me, that's a spy.
This is so astute, John. You're the best one on the program to talk about this, actually.
Well, I'd really love to hear your opinions.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I believe absolutely right. But if there's a hostile power involved, then you go to the organization they're spying on, and say we want to help you stop this interference.
Exactly.
And but the very minimum implication is they did not trust the Trump campaign not to be collaborating with it. So they were not just a spying on the Russians, trying to find out what the Russians. They were trying to find out what people in the Trump campaign were doing. Period.
Yeah.
And Patrick, this isn't really unprecedented in U.S. history either. I mean, there's this sort of fairy tale about U.S. politics and democracy that we learn in school. But I mean, dirty tricks like these, you know, using intelligence agencies, other institutions of the state to intervene in electoral contests. I mean, that's part of the game, right?
Yeah. It is. My analysis of this is I go to a metaphor having to do with machinery. Machines have machines have design tolerances, okay? A little kid's toy has a design tolerance of 6 months. It's going to break, right? An M1 tank has a design tolerance of many years, all right? This Russiagate nonsense had a design tolerance that expired, that was meant to expire November 8th of 2016. It would all just pass away and Hillary would be president. Basically, what we have ever since are the Democrats, Jim's deep state, and the media collaborating, each one of those exceedingly powerful, right, collaborating to keep operating a machine whose design tolerance has long ago expired. It's getting to be, I was telling a foreign friend the other day, it's getting to be so silly, I don't even really want to talk to people about it anymore. It's not a rational conversation. It's an emperor with no clothes thing. The very bald facts of it are just irrefutable, but you can't, it's a matter of belief. You know, it's not thought. We're not talking to people who think. We're talking to people who believe. They're too heavily invested. You know, that's my take on this at this point. The Halper thing, really great that John parsed that term, right? It was so interesting to read the Times report. These people are turning themselves into pretzels every morning.
I said the same thing. How many different ways can they twist themselves over this?
As I said in a recent column, I don't read the Times to find out what happened and why. I read the Times to find out what I'm supposed to think happened and why, and then I go in search of what happened and why, right? In this case, the term informant, I didn't know about the whole debate, informant, whatever, as I first had my coffee and read that piece on the front of the Times, right? And then later I realized they are faithfully adhering to FBI, CIA terminology. It was informant. And there was a great phrase, John. The informant, in his conversations with unsuspecting members of the Trump campaign, unsuspecting, what does that mean other than spying? Forgive me, you know?
Yeah, you're exactly right.
The media, they're getting to be too much, right?
Jim, how about you? What's your take on this? How, and, you know, let me be more specific. The Democrats went out of their way yesterday to come down on exactly the opposite side, saying this was not spying. It was a CI, that the Russians are attacking our democracy, and they didn't see anything in these classified documents that would cause them to change their minds.
Well, you know, it is getting, like, as Patrick said, so silly to talk about this. I mean, when I first saw this a few days ago or on the news, it's not a spy, it's an informant. I said, what are they talking about? What's this semantic distinction they're trying to make? Why would they even bother to try? They don't like Trump. We know they don't like Trump. We know what they were trying to do, which is to find out, A, what the Russians had on Hillary, if anything, and B, whether Trump was going to use what the Russians had on Hillary. I mean, everybody knows that's what's going on. So you were trying to do that surreptitiously through an informant who wasn't identifying himself as trying to do that to the people he was talking to. It's a spy. I don't know why he would even bother not.
Yeah.
Because it's they're trying, as Patrick said, they never thought this would go beyond the election.
No, you're exactly right.
This was the sell-by date was the election, because this was an attempt to work against the Trump campaign during the election. Then when Trump was elected, they went into panic mode and said, oh, we can try and use this now to get him out of office, which is not going to work. And he's just creating a kind of rat's nest of, you know, or that's being opened up, and the rats are running all over the place, and nobody knows who to squash or who not to squash, who to indict or who not to indict for money laundering or lobbying or influence peddling, which is the normal business model of Washington. So it's all just it's silly at this point.
Yeah. You know, I've given up on this is not a win for those who wish to talk sense. I start to turn to the historians that if you look at the history of American coups, you know, CIA operations. John will know it well, right? The most famous sure. ones, Guatemala, Iran, and so on, right? We were able to talk about them in semi-honest language only after it ceased to matter, right? And I think that's what we... I've been wondering, what's the side door here? Where are these people going to go when the game is up? Well, they're not going to go anywhere. I don't mean to be so pessimistic, but I'm afraid it's my point of view now. It's not a win. The historians will sort it out. But then one is reliant upon the academics, and they're not the most courageous people around, right? So I qualify it. A few historians will get to the bottom of this, you know, the sort of Gabriel Kolkos of the next generation or something, right? I just don't think we're going to find our way through this because we in this program are having a rational conversation, but you can't have these kind of conversations with people who are so heavily invested, right? I reckon, maybe John has a thought, I reckon it was the same when maybe a few voices were raised after Guatemala City in 54 or some other such operation. You couldn't have a... It was just blotted out. And one of the things that was quite striking in the last couple of days of Korea coverage... This is not Russiagate, but Korea coverage. Same thing. It was absolutely blanket. It had to be North Korea's fault, right? American righteousness and American innocence were absolutely had to be preserved. Suddenly, the North turned hostile. No explanation as to why they turned hostile. They did. Mm-hmm. But no explanation of why, so causality, the old American trick, throw causality out the window and present a few isolated facts without explanation, right? That's what we're getting with Russiagate. It's what we're getting in Iran. Concluding point, it's hard to have rational conversations about this stuff now. Forgive me for being discouraged, right?
We've got 3 minutes left. I hope you don't mind if we switch it to Iran. Walter, you had a question that you wanted to raise.
Yeah. We heard this speech by Mike Pompeo earlier this week. I think this was the other, you know, major story of the week that we haven't talked about yet. And it really sounded to me like this was a prelude to war, you know, not a war in the next couple weeks, maybe, or next couple months, but, you know, sometime in the near term. Pompeo was basically setting out this list of demands that were so outrageous that it would be impossible to meet, and then it would give a pretext for some further act of aggression. It was sort of like what Saudi Arabia did to Qatar earlier this year, where they issued this like unbelievable list of demands, like closing Al Jazeera, basically surrendering your sovereignty. You know, these are demands that are not meant to be met. They're demands that are meant to be impossible. So, and in our last, maybe we could just get a minute from each of you. What are your thoughts? Is war with Iran more on the horizon now as a consequence of Mike Pompeo's quote unquote Plan B speech? Patrick, let's start with you.
I didn't think so until Washington betrayed the Europeans. All right.
Right.
I certainly think it's. I think it's where the hawkish wing in Washington wants to head. Yes, Bolton, American Enterprise people. This nitwit Nick Eberstadt. I love reading him. He's so senseless. Yes, I think that's where they're going. In my view, I'll wrap it so Jim has some time. I think Washington now has two very large gambles on the table, a lot of chips. We're abandoning the Europeans, and we're abandoning our Pacific allies, one in the North Korea context and the other, of course, in the Iranian. At a certain point, there has to be a break point out there at some point, at some moment, when these powers say, you know, we can't do it anymore. We're going our own way. It's daring. I mean, the extent to which we've told the Europeans, signatories of the Iran Accord, we're hanging you out to dry, and we're going to sanction you if you disobey. And now, doing plus minus the same in different contexts to the South Koreans and provoking the Chinese, right? Recklessly provoking the Chinese. I find it quite. I can only conclude that they really do, that Washington does not have a sound grip on the realities of our moment.
We are going to have to leave it there. Unfortunately, we're completely out of time. We were joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh. Jim is the editor of thepolemicist.net. And we were joined from Norfolk, Connecticut by Patrick Lawrence. He's the author of Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century. He's a columnist at The Nation, and you can support his work at www.patreon.com/theflautist. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
I'm Walter Smolarik, filling in for Brian Becker.
The country is inching closer to midterm elections in November, and more states held primary elections this week. We'll look at those races and more political news. We're joined here in the studio by Dr. Wilmer Leon. He's a political scientist and author, and he's the host of a nationally broadcast talk radio show on Sirius XM Channel 126. But he will also start his own show here on Sputnik on Tuesday. It's called Critical Hour. And it's going to run Monday through Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. Be sure to tune in. Wilmer, welcome back.
Thank you very much, John.
You know, for being sort of in a slow period politically, there was a lot that happened this week. And I want to start with this gubernatorial primary election in Georgia. It was a very big deal. And it was a big deal because Stacey Abrams won the Democratic nomination to be governor of Georgia. If she wins, she would be the first black woman in American history to be elected governor and the first woman to be elected governor in the state of Georgia. The reason why her campaign is important is that she has used grassroots appeal and voter turnout like a champ. Other campaigns ought to learn from this woman because she knew exactly what she was doing. This was a race that was supposed to be close, and she ended up getting 74%. Do you think she's got a real shot at becoming governor?
I think she does. And that doesn't mean that she's going to win. To your question.
It's Georgia, after all.
It is Georgia. And she has a very, very steep hill to climb. But she's demonstrating an understanding of data. She's understanding how to use data. And she's also understanding the buttons to push in terms of messaging and what's resonating with Georgians, and I think all of those things will only prove to make this race much closer than I think mainstream pundits are willing to admit. And what I think is even more significant is the question to me, where is the Democratic Party here? Because a lot of her messaging,
that's right,
is, I won't say antithetical, but it's not consistent. It's more progressive.
It is.
Than the Democratic Party wants the national message to be, to the detriment of the Democratic Party.
And we saw exactly the same thing on Tuesday in Texas, where you had several female Democrats who had not been endorsed by the party beat more mainstream Democratic challengers. This is a wave. I want to come back to it in a couple of minutes because people are calling it the Bernie wave. And then at the same time, it kind of looks like Bernie Sanders has lost control of this wave. We'll get back to that.
Okay.
I want to talk about this Georgia race. So Stacey Abrams, as you said, she's a master at the use of data. And I'm going to go out on a limb a little bit and say that we may be seeing a perfect storm this year, in that Republican turnout will likely be slightly depressed because Congress is so wildly unpopular,
mm-hmm.
and the president has his own popularity problems, even in the South,
mm-hmm.
number one. Number two, the African-American vote in Georgia continues to grow. Number three, and nobody's paying attention to this, but the Hispanic vote in Georgia continues to grow. So I wonder if it really just depends on turnout. Now, the Republicans have two people that are going to face off for the gubernatorial nomination in July because nobody got a majority. So it's Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle, who was the top Republican vote getter, and the Secretary of State, Brian Kemp. We don't know yet who the nominee is going to be, but between now and the July runoff, they're going to spend all their money just killing each other to try to win this thing. And they're going to have to start from scratch financially. She's not going to have to start from scratch. And I can't help but to think if she's got a leg up and with this single-minded focus on turnout, I think she can win this thing.
I think she very well could win this election. It's also important to remember that she has a very long and positive history in Georgia state politics in terms because she comes out of the state legislature.
That's right.
She really understands her constituencies. And, you know, it's funny when I hear people say the election is based on turnout. It's always based on turnout.
It is.
The question is, can you get your people to the polls?
That's it.
What the analytics now enables candidates to do is to drill deeper and deeper and deeper, where we used to go, say, city by city, and then we went county by county, and then we went district or precinct. But now we can go block by block.
That's right. Literally
go look at the data block by block and understand, well, the message that you're saying on 4th Street needs to be tweaked a little bit when you get to 7th Street. And she really has captured that and understands how to use that. And not only is there a large Hispanic population or electorate in Georgia, there is a growing overall immigrant population. There are Ethiopians mm-hmm. there. There's a tremendous immigrant wave in Georgia that many people might be taking for granted
underestimating. They're mostly heading to Atlanta, and the economy there is very robust.
Yes.
And so it's attracting even more people from all around the world, really.
And these state-level races, you know, like Stacey Abrams, of course, running for governor, and then there's the state legislatures as well, even though, you know, the congressional races are getting the most attention this cycle. When it comes to redistricting, which really in the long term is going to decide control of the House of Representatives, because, you know, for the last 10 years, everything has been so terribly gerrymandered that the Republicans had like a massive institutional advantage. Like these state level races are actually like really crucial for national politics as well, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, they really are. And I want to say something also about Stacey Abrams. She didn't just walk in off the street.
No.
She's really got a resume.
Yes.
She's a graduate of Yale Law School, mm-hmm. for example. She calls herself a daughter of the Deep South. She's from Georgia. She's lived in Georgia all of her entire life. She got herself elected to the state legislature, and she's written a series of best-selling romance novels.
Mm-hmm.
It's like she's a Renaissance woman, not a professional politician. She's also been an entrepreneur, and she built a business from scratch.
And to me, to be able to be a successful romance novelist means you have to know how to communicate.
That is exactly right.
You have to know how to communicate. And I've listened to her. I've been in Georgia. I've seen her out and about. She knows how to communicate. And I listened to her acceptance speech, and I think the first thing she talked about was energy independence through renewables and green energy.
Mm-hmm.
For that to be the first point that she touched on in her acceptance speech, I thought was very telling, very telling. And Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi and Tom Perrett, they need to be talking to her and they need to be listening to her,
mm-hmm.
because there are a lot of Stacey Abrams out there that mainstream Democratic, the hierarchy is dismissing and ignoring.
That's right.
To their peril.
I want to come back to this Bernie Sanders issue. After Bernie Sanders, quote unquote, lost the Democratic primary in 2016, I don't think he did lose it, but the numbers weren't there. His top operatives formed a group called Our Revolution, right? And it was supposed to to maintain the mailing lists. It was supposed to raise money for a couple of reasons. One, to finance Bernie Sanders' 2020 presidential campaign, but then also to donate money to progressive candidates around the country in order to essentially collect political chits that Bernie could cash in for the 2020 primaries. What's ended up happening, though, is the only thing they've accomplished is they've maintained this mailing list. They've tried to get involved in races around the country, and they've failed. Politico had an article just a couple of days ago in which it said, despite possessing Sanders' email list, which is the envy of the Democratic Party, it can claim no major wins in 2018 as its own. Even more seriously, though, there's infighting in this group. And so they have found themselves either refusing to back progressive Democratic candidates who had backed Bernie Sanders in 2016 or actively campaigning against them. So my question to you, Wilmer, is, are we seeing the beginning of the end of Bernie Sanders as a national political figure here, or is this something that can be corrected?
I don't think we're seeing the end of Bernie Sanders as a national political figure, but what I think you're seeing is the Democratic Party absorbing Bernie Sanders
And we've seen that in his Senate votes as well.
Absolutely.
He's been very, very mainstream in his Senate votes.
And whereas Bernie was the progressive outlier in the 2016 campaign, the infighting within the Democratic Party makes it almost as though the Bernie folks, the Bernieacs, are almost on the verge of a third party. And I mean, I don't mean that technically. I mean that more ideologically.
Yes.
Virtually.
Remember, Bernie Sanders is not a Democrat.
He's a registered independent.
Yep.
And so the infighting between the Bernies and the Democrats, to a certain degree, was putting them on the verge of being a virtual third party. And we know in this country, third parties are very, very hard to run. Bernie's primary idea is Medicare for all, which is a great, great idea. It's a great plank, but it's not a platform.
Yeah.
It's a great idea, but it's not a movement. And so Bernie to me hasn't been able to develop his politics beyond the Medicaid for all to and touch on and champion significantly other issues that's really putting pressure on the Democratic Party and forcing them to make decisions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I agree with a lot of what you're saying. You know, I'm on the Our Revolution mailing list, and I got an email, and it's, you know, the sender line was like Bernie Sanders, and the subject line is "I'm running." And of course, he was talking about his reelection campaign in 2018, which is not the thing that everybody is going to think that means when they open it up.
Right.
And so, you know, like you're saying, you know, really all they have left at this point is like the personality of Bernie Sanders. And that's how they're sort of motivating people. And I think that the moment has sort of moved past that. Like, Bernie Sanders played a particular role in the 2016 election, which I thought was very positive in terms of like opening the field of, you know, what's acceptable to think about in mainstream politics, you know, what ideas, you know, the word socialism itself is not like this boogeyman anymore. I mean, that was sort of happening before Sanders,
right.
But it played a big role in sort of keeping that process going. And so, you know, now, like you're saying, I think there's sort of this phenomenon that has moved past Bernie Sanders, the individual politician.
Well, and, you know, I don't know. I think here's the quote unquote conspiracy theorist in me coming out. I think the Obama faction, the Clinton faction, the Schumer and the Pelosi faction, the Tom Perez faction, they've leaned on Bernie pretty hard. And I think Bernie is succumbing to that pressure, and he's falling in line instead of holding his ground, saying no, no, no. Because, for example, look at Nina Turner, right? And there are issues now with Nina Turner, who was Bernie's, was she his spokesperson or his campaign? She was his campaign manager, I believe.
Campaign manager. That's right.
And so now she's saying that the Democrats lost because they've lost their way. They lost their message. They lost their focus, and they forgot why we really were, or still are, I hope, the party of working people. So she's championing that grassroots, fundamental democracy, democratic line that folks traditionally, at least for the last 50 years, have assigned to the Democratic Party. And now she's almost sounding like, the lone wolf, or she's sounding like the individual voice in the wilderness.
And, you know, the Washington Post is saying that there are as many as 22 Democrats right now who are considering running for president. 22 Democrats. You remember people made fun of the, 17 Republicans right. that ran for president last time because they had to split the debates between the A team and the B team.
Right.
Well, the same thing is happening to the Democrats now, and it's going to be easy for that message that you just talked about to get lost. A lot of people are going to be talking.
A lot of people are going to be talking. And so the question becomes, or the question still is, because I've been asking this question for at least 8 years, what is the message in terms of the Democrats? Whenever I get a call from the Democratic Senate Committee or the Democratic House Committee yep. and they start asking me for money, I tell them, stop. Let me ask you one question. In three sentences, can you tell me what is the message? And they can never what we stand for. What is the message? I said, I tell them, you should have at the top of your script highlighted in yellow what your message is.
Mm-hmm.
They can't do it. No. They don't have one.
You know, it's funny, too, because that's a lesson that each party learns every 2 years, and they just can't get it right. We say on this show all the time, have the Democrats, for example, learned nothing from the 1994 contract with America? It worked. It was a message. You may disagree with it. Right. I did, but it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And the Democrats in all these years have just not been able to replicate that.
The Democrats don't have a Frank Luntz. And for those who don't know, Frank Luntz is the Republican pollster that has developed the art of political speak.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one that came up with Obamacare. He went from the Affordable Care Act, we'll call it Obamacare. He's the one that came up with, the contract with America.
Uh-huh.
All of these key Republican slogans go back to Frank Luntz and his understanding. He's the one that came up with the death tax.
Right.
That was him. That was Frank Luntz.
Yeah.
And he understands very clearly how to distill a message into a phrase that resonates to their target audience.
Yeah.
And the Democrats just don't have
No, Bob Shrum's not writing speeches anymore.
Mm-mm.
The 80s were a long time ago.
Right.
I want to switch to Texas. There were a couple of fascinating races that took place on Tuesday in Texas. One is far more important than the other. So let's do the less important one first. A woman named Lupe Valdez won the Democratic nomination for governor. She would challenge Governor Abbott. Governor Abbott's pretty popular.
Mm-hmm.
He also has $40 million saved in his campaign war chest and ran unopposed in the Republican primary. Lupe Valdez was an army captain.
Mm-hmm.
She saw combat in the Middle East. She is the sheriff of Dallas County. And she would be the first Hispanic lesbian to be elected governor of any state in America. Nobody's talking about that. There was one brief article in CNN Politics, and then that was it. Nobody mentioned her again. I suspect it's because she had a tough primary. She has no money, and she's going up against a guy who's a proven fundraiser. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think that the Democrats are still making the grand mistake of trying to put their money on what are the obvious winners. And they don't really understand in many instances you have to invest in order to eventually see the return. And what I have been seeing with both Texas as well as Arizona for the last probably 10 years is the margins are narrowing. And primarily because the Hispanic vote, the Latino vote, I understand the term Hispanic can be some pejorative to some. The Latino vote is becoming more significant. So what I see is in some instances, you have to understand I'm not going to win this race this year, but can I force my opponent to spend more money
right.
to maintain it
right.
than they had planned to?
Right.
And if I can force them to spend more money, then I know I'm making progress. I can figure out where some of their vulnerabilities are. And I can slowly build a base to capitalize on them. I don't see the Democrats being that forward thinking.
I have to agree with you. And that allows me to segue into another race. This is a congressional race outside of Houston. The district has been represented for something like 8 terms, 16 years, by a Republican named John Culberson.
Mm-hmm.
John Culberson is sort of a gadfly here in Washington. He's known for collecting space artifacts and historical artifacts, and that's really all he ever wants to talk about. And so you don't see him much on the news shows or anything because he, you know, wants to talk about Thomas Jefferson's pen that he found at an auction or a meteorite that he found someplace.
Mm-hmm.
In any event,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's never had any problems winning re-election. Never. He's always been reelected.
This is Abraham Lincoln's highlight.
That's right. He always wins by huge margins. But as it turns out, Hillary Clinton won his district last time. That shocked everybody. But it shows you the changing demographics in suburban Houston. So there's a woman named Lizzie Fletcher who was a constituent of his. And she went to a town hall meeting last year. And she listened to him talk about Obamacare and gun control and abortion, and she disagreed with everything that he said. She said that she went up to him afterwards, she shook his hand, they had a polite exchange, and then she decided, I'm going to run for Congress against this guy. He's a nice guy, but I'm opposed to everything that he stands for. Well, she won her primary, and all of a sudden, she's a serious candidate. She showed an ability to raise money. She's young. She's 43 years old. She is an attorney. She's quite successful. And she's ready for the long haul. Politico is saying that this may be the most obvious turnover in Texas. Everybody else is looking at Texas as 23rd. Will Hurd is running against, we're not even really sure yet because we need to see who comes out of the runoff. Will Hurd's never won more than 49%. In his races, and he's an African American man running in a Supreme Court mandated majority Latino district. So he wins like in spite of himself. And he's a conservative Republican on top of it. Well, maybe that's not the close race that everybody should be watching. They should be watching this Fletcher Culbertson race. What do you think?
Well, I think that's a very, very good point. I know that Fletcher had a real challenge from Laura Moser.
She sure did.
She had a challenge from Laura.
In fact, CNN sort of made a funny ha-ha article about it that the two agreed on literally every single issue.
Right.
And when they went to debate, there was no debate. They just agreed with each other.
Exactly. Exactly. I hate to keep beating this drum, but it goes back to what's the message? And
yeah.
And where it, you know, Tom Perez talked about a 50 state campaign that they were going to challenge every seat. They have to put their money where their mouth is. And to say that we're going to run a 50 state campaign doesn't mean that all candidates are going to be the same and that all messages are going to be the same. They can't be because all issues aren't the same. But I think there still has to be kind of an umbrella. This is what we stand for. This is what we're going to champion. And then under that umbrella, there are going raindrops do still get in under your umbrella. They still have to figure out the issues that Lizzie Fletcher will address in Texas may not resonate in California.
Right.
But they don't have to.
That's right.
And the Democrats need to be broad-minded enough to be able to articulate that, that we can support a Lizzie Fletcher in Texas and we can support Kamala Harris. We can support Kamala Harris and Lizzie Fletcher in the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
In
fact, but then we have to be sure.
That's what makes the big tent the big tent.
It is. And I agree with you completely. This is what Howard Dean was arguing 20 years ago.
Exactly.
But we have to be careful not to get angry at ourselves when somebody like Joe Manchin votes with the Republicans. Because the point is, and you make it quite well, if you have a big tent party, then you control the chairmanships and you control the congressional agenda because you're going to have a majority. And the Democrats haven't quite figured that out.
And I'm glad you brought up Joe Manchin in West Virginia, because I believe the fundamental premise of your message has to be a moral message. And if the fundamental premise of your message is moral, then we can debate particular applications or particular policy initiatives based upon there's no coal in Texas, but there's a hell of a lot of it in West Virginia.
Right.
But the morality behind this should never, ever be inconsistent.
Yes.
So at the end of the day, when it comes down to, are we protecting our environment? Do we want clean water? Do we want clean air? Well, yeah, we do. That doesn't mean that you can't champion uses of coal in West Virginia in limited circumstances, but we still have to have a clean air policy. We still have to have a clean water policy, and we can't do away with the Environmental Protection Agency.
Yeah, that's right. We have something like 3 minutes left, and I want to jump to what has quickly become one of the most popular parlor games in Washington, and that is trying to decide if Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy is going to resign or not. The country, at least the city, went through this a year ago, last spring. Now everybody's talking about it again. The Hill newspaper had a very long article about it this week, saying, like clockwork, Washington has whipped itself into a frenzy over rumors of a possible retirement on the Supreme Court. All eyes are on Justice Anthony Kennedy, 81, who reportedly considered calling it quits last year. As the court's current term winds to a close, speculation about his plans has again swept the Capitol, with court watchers searching for clues. Why does Anthony Kennedy want to resign or retire now? What's the difference?
Well, he's 81. He's probably wanting to spend time with his grandkids or go on a boat somewhere. I would ask the other question. If he's not retiring, why isn't he retiring? And I think the answer is because Anthony Kennedy, being a Reagan appointee, but still being a swing vote, which shows that he was a very rational guy.
I was hoping you weren't going to say that because I wanted to say it.
Oh, well, then I'll be quiet since it's your show. Go ahead.
No, I'm with you 100%.
I think he, kind of like Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Yes.
They see themselves as the beachhead. They see themselves, if we go, the country's going to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah.
And I think he's going to hold on for that reason for as long as he possibly can.
Yeah, the longer he holds on, the easier it is for us to analyze his position on Donald Trump. If he continues to hang on, it's because he just doesn't like Donald Trump.
I think you're absolutely right.
And I think that he sees himself as the only thing standing between national consensus on a whole bunch of issues and a hard right Supreme Court.
I think you're right. And whether it's a hard right Supreme Court or a hard left Supreme Court, each extreme is dangerous.
It is.
When it comes to judicial assessment and when it comes to, you know, judicial jurisprudence and mentality, Either extreme is dangerous.
I agree. We are out of time. I love these political segments. I could sit here all day and just talk about politics, but we can't. We're out of time. We were joined in the studio by Dr. Wilmer Leon. He is a political scientist and author, and he's the host of a nationally broadcast talk radio show on Sirius XM, Channel 126. More importantly, he will start his own show here on Sputnik on Tuesday. It's called Critical Hour, and it's going to run Monday through Friday from 6 to 7 p.m. Be sure to tune in. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.